Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 166, Questioning Buddhism with Robert Thurman.
Study Buddhism. What does it bring to people to study Buddhism? Well, I think in academia, like I teach a course introducing Buddhism to undergraduate students at various levels, and that's really not an issue. It's in a religious studies department, and it's a matter of sort of general learning about the nature of the world. There is such a thing as a religion called Buddhism, and you study its history, beginning with the founder, presumably who existed, called Buddha. But in academia, everything is to be questioned. So you join the Reverend Nagasena, Venerable Nagasena, in the Melinda Questions of King Melinda, who already said, how do you know there was such a person as the Buddha? And there's an answer to that even given in the second century before the Common Era. So you study all that sort of thing, and then people you learn about what many people in the history of the world, maybe a majority considering the high populations of India and China, even in ancient time, believed in. So you learn that, you know, then you learn that that's learning that's a world religion. Now, the way I really, however, I'd like to address it, not necessarily in academia, but not as concerned so much with the history. But I like to teach it in a sort of primary meaning level, that Buddhism is actually not really what the Buddha taught. What the Buddha taught was three types of higher education. His Eightfold Path, which is the fourth of his Four Noble Truths, which is sort of his original framework of teaching, and everything later in his teaching, or as expansive as it becomes, can be fit into that. But that Eightfold Path is a path of three education. It has eight branches which fit into three higher educations. Now, you read Buddhist translators constantly saying three higher trainings, but I consider that training is a better word for a soldier among humans, and maybe dogs and cats and horses and other animals who are trained to do this and that. Whereas shiksha means education, learning something. Adishiksha means intense education or higher education, you could say. So the three education higher educations are educations in ethics, educations in mind control and understanding of the mind and use of the mind, and education in wisdom, which means education in the nature of reality and the investigation of the nature of reality, critical examination and exploration of reality. And those three higher educations really correspond kind of to the ethics one, and sort of politics, sociology, society, you know, relates to that. The higher education in mind is relates to psychology, but really it relates to something we don't have in the West so much, which is training you how to use your mind, where you change your psyche, actually, rather than what is your mind. Because in a way, that you have a mind is a given in Buddhist science. And finally, the most important of them, ultimately, to achieve liberation, freedom, lessening of suffering, lessening and freedom from suffering, is the education in wisdom, which means the exploration of reality, which is actually science. And Buddhism... To why study Buddhism? You're studying, within studying Buddhism, when you look at it as the three higher educations, then you are studying an ancient way of examining the nature of reality, a non-materialistic dogma-dominated science about the nature of reality with the mind involved. It isn't a spiritualistic or non-rational thing or sort of blind faith beliefs like people think of religion. That's how people think of religion as. But it is a very critical, rational, logical, but also empirical, experiential, and perceptual training and education in how to perceive reality. And the learning about the use of the mind is in order to improve your scientific instrument with which you do investigate reality, which is your own mind. And your ethics really has to do with how you should behave to not be in a turbulent lifestyle of conflict with other people by being more other-sensitive, which means ethical, other-regarding, as I think they say, some ethicists say, about how you act with people so as not to provoke them, not to poke them, not to bother them, like some people I know don't tend to do. And so you study Buddhism to improve your ability to use your mind to investigate reality, see how others did investigate reality and how what they came up with in regard to theory, although luckily the Buddhist scientists, philosophers, you know, yogis, great masters, like Buddha, did not have a dogmatic theory of the nature of reality because they decided that reality is beyond pinning down by theory. And theory is very helpful in how to orient yourself in order to try to experience and to investigate the nature of reality. But theory doesn't capture the nature of reality. The nature of reality is beyond theory. But it is not beyond experience. We do experience it. And then we tend to misinterpret our experience, as was Buddha's insight, which he called ignorance or misknowing. And so the idea is to correct that misknowing, to properly and correctly and fully know the nature of reality, which one Buddhist theory is that it's fully possible to do. So the best way of studying Buddhism is to study it not as religion, but as a set of scientific theories, activities, texts, and traditions that you can employ for your own investigation. And just like when you learn biology, you don't consider yourself to be a member of the religion of biologism. So therefore, when you study that, you're using the services, the mental, physical, emotional, intellectual services that Buddhism offers human beings to become more aware of the nature of reality. And this brings me to my favorite slogan that I use nowadays after 50 years of teaching this, which is that what is Buddhism? Ultimately, Buddhism is realism. So Buddhism means that you want to know what reality is. And based on a certain faith coming from the experience of the Buddha himself, who said, wow, when you know reality, you're going to be free from that suffering, which comes from your misknowing your reality at the moment. So when you know it accurately and precisely, then you will be free of suffering. And that's a very encouraging and maybe, who knows, maybe overly optimistic prescription, you could say. But based on that, there's a tendency in the Buddhist science to want to know more always about the nature of reality. Never to think that ignorance is bliss, but only that realistic knowledge is bliss. That's sort of the general perspective and orientation with which one engages in the study of the Buddhist sciences. So that would be my answer to that question. Okay. Second question, what is the benefit of studying Buddhism as an academic subject? Well, there we go back to what I had said in the other answer, where it is very valuable to study as an academic subject. After all, in academia, we have courses in the religious beliefs of other nations. We even consider secularism, perhaps, as a kind of religion of scientism or religion of materialism, something like that, we could say, if we really treat it in a sociologically sophisticated manner in the tradition of Peter Berger, Thomas Luckmann, and other great, what they call themselves, sociologists of knowledge. But among that, Buddhism is a major set of human phenomena, historical phenomena, and social phenomena, which involves many people's beliefs, many people's activities, many people's theories and institutions that they built and so forth in many different countries, texts which were translated into many different languages with greater and lesser degrees of accuracy and success, and also the histories of individuals who found great benefit in practicing the Buddhist educational method of their ethics and their mind and their intellect, and and their realistic experiences. And so studying all of that is sort of what academic study of Buddhism does. And that's very, very valuable. And for some, it could be an entry after studying academically where they'd want to be a Buddhist. But in academia, fortunately, one of the great things about liberal academics in the world is that there is no preferred dogma under which people investigate things. And so, although on at least in theory, in practice, of course, teachers do bring their prejudices. And I would say that the secular prejudice that you find, which is the dominant motif underlying American university campuses, and I think to a certain extent European ones and modern Asian ones as well, is that secularism is sort of reality. And that's not presented as if it were a theory, that's presented as if it were a fact. And in that sense, it is kind of religious. In other words, you just have to accept it, that only matter exists, mind is some sort of old-fashioned superstition, a spirit, forget about it, that's an ancient religious fanatic thing with no evidence to back it up and so on. I'm afraid that is actually the dogma of our academies, in which the natural scientists are something like the high priest. The social scientists are wannabe high priests, but they are good in helping us study the nature of human behavior and social behavior, and they're wonderful traditions, actually, and disciplines. But there's a little bit closed-mindedness about it because of the dogma of materialism that rules on the campuses, you know, which is a good, actually, response to the former kind of Christian university or Buddhist university or Jewish university, yeshiva type of place, where you have a dogma of some religious belief system. So this is but this unfortunately has become a new dogma of a materialistic belief system. And in a way that then prejudices people. So for example, in philosophy departments in America, you don't get to study Buddhism in a philosophy department, really. You have to study it in a religious studies department where it's sort of a human phenomenon. And there it's dominated by the idea that the founding principle of Buddhism, which is that it's possible for the human being to achieve a higher type of consciousness, a Buddha consciousness, awakened consciousness, an enlightened consciousness. And that kind of consciousness sees deeper, sees better, more accurately, more precisely in the nature of reality than ordinary misknowing consciousness. And so Buddhist studies kind of a little bit politely tiptoes around that idea, which is at the foundation of Buddhism, but basically is based on a disbelief in that belief. So, for example, in PhD, people who get PhDs in Buddhist studies have to kind of accept a dogma from their professors, at least a little bit more stringently than nowadays. But when I was early on supervising PhD dissertations, you know, 40 years ago, you know, you can't act like there is such a thing as enlightenment. If you do that, you're accepting uncritically some, you know, crazy people's predisposed idea, and you have to sort of automatically assume that Buddha was just a kind of Socrates. He had an orange toga. He didn't drink ricina. You know, he criticized the gods, but he talked to the gods, supposedly. So in a way, there's a presupposed idea of theistic idea in Indian culture, but he didn't exactly subscribe to it. But he didn't completely cancel every aspect of it. In other words, he relativized it. In other words, he said, "Oh yeah, well, I talked to Brahma the other day, and Brahma admitted to me that he didn't know how the world worked, because he didn't actually create it, but he's a big, powerful being in it." So that kind of idea, you know. So what is that? That's hard to know, you know. Anyway, still, whatever predisposition you're studying it, even if you study it in a Catholic university where the predisposition, like by a Jesuit teacher or something, is that Buddhism is untrue and that there is no such thing as a Buddha. He was a person who was a, you know, clever person and a teacher of people. But since he wasn't Christian, he couldn't be even not only and not enlightened, but he couldn't be saved even. So there's that kind of a predisposition on top of it. But nevertheless, even under that, to learn about it is still useful. To learn that people believed this, they did that, they meditate the other way, they had this and that institution, they had this and that ethical theory, they had this and that philosophical theory, is very valuable anyway. So not to worry. Whatever you do in that light is fine. Okay, so that's the value of the academic study of Buddhism. Okay, so the next question, is Buddhism a science? I would not say Buddhism is a science. I think that would be, if we think of Buddhism, the ism part means sort of it relates to being a religion, like Hinduism, Confucianism, Taoism, Christianism, but we use Christianity as a general suffix. So ism sort of automatically assumes a religion. And I agree that Buddhism is a religion for those who do not use its educational system very fully. And in Asian history, since most of the societies for a long period of time were sort of semi-literate or very non-literate societies, and very few people were educated, only the upper classes, and then later Buddhist monks and nuns, once Buddhism was in that society, were literate. And so your unliterate farmer who would be taught a sort of pious sermon by a Buddhist monk or basic ethical precepts, etc., and might observe the example of Buddhist monks being self-restrained and not over-emotional and not, like, angry and so forth, hopefully, usually. So for them, it's a religion. In other words, they believe that the Buddha must have been a good person, perhaps enlightened, whatever they think enlightenment might mean. They have still divinities. Buddhism never took people's divinities away from them, but it just de-absolutized them, relativized them, made them maybe less fanatical or attempted to. And so for them, it's definitely a religion, you have to say. But was Buddha's main purpose to found a religion? I don't really think so. He more was rebelling against the Vedic, what I call Vedism, or Vedic Hinduism, you could say, or Vedism, which believed that Veda was the word of God, just like fundamentalist Christians today believe the Bible is the word of God, or fundamentalist Jews believe that the Torah is the word of God. So they believed the Vedas were the word of God, and they followed priests' injunctions, and they didn't consider that you rationally had to somehow understand it, that human rationality had shaped in some way these teachings supposedly received in visions or revelations from God. And so he rebelled against that, the Buddha did, and he felt the human being could understand their world and their reality, and he was definitely tried to do so. And he felt finally that he was successful. But in a way, ironically, in succeeding, he said, what succeeds is experience. You can experience, your understanding becomes experience, realistic experience, and then you're really in touch with reality, let's say. And unfortunately, that the way reality is beyond encapsulation in any theory. Theories are useful, however, as part of it in giving you an orientation toward developing valid experience, but ultimately experience rules. And I would say that modern science is the same as that, and they say that experiment and measurement and evidence supersede theory, and theory is hypothetical, awaiting either confirmation or disconfirmation by whatever degree of data and evidence that you have. And in that sense, data and evidence is gathered by experience, which they call experiment, and they consider it to be sort of mathematical measurement, perhaps a quantitative measurement, but that's just they're based on them being ruled by a particular dogma that the mind is not an active energy in nature, which is kind of funny when you think that, they pose this puzzle, how could the mind matter when everything we can observe is material? But actually, energy has no mass. And so you can't say in a way that it's matter in the same sense as something that has mass is matter. So like an atom or like a something made up of atomic particles, like a box or a chair or a floor. So how does a thing without mass affect thing with mass? There's a kind of puzzle even in that. And which goes to show you that the ancient Buddhist insight that words themselves are only partial sort of facets of the things they seem to refer to. And there's no essence in a thing that the word captures or refers to. It as old-fashioned Western metaphysics and old-fashioned Vedist metaphysics thought. Buddha was rebelling against and criticizing those things, you know. So I would say that the main thing about Buddhism, especially that's of use to people who don't intend to become Buddhists, and in the modern world where religions are all rubbing up against each other in the same cities, the same communities, the same towns, and where religious pluralism seems to be the only social practice that is in a way conducive to social harmony, therefore in such kind of multi-religious societies, then the leaders of Buddhism that I most respect and I think are most reasonable in relation to the reality of modern societies, like the Dalai Lama, who say that they don't want to convert you to Buddhism, that it's not necessary to try to convert each other. And he requests, he deeply implores Christians and Muslims and Hindus and Taoists, if he had met more of them, not to try to convert people to their theory. And actually, we should be imploring secularists not to try to convert people to their materialist theory, but rather see what good things they have achieved with their different theories and share them and let other people adopt them without necessarily having to enter into the body of those theorists or sort of some membership, you could say, in another religion, or convert to that religion, or convert to the anti-religion religion of secularism, whatever it is. That would be preferable that we don't do that with each other. And instead, we offer the services that the Buddhist sciences have elaborated that could be helpful possibly to us in our scientific approach toward the nature of reality, that is to say, our activity focused on seeking to know what is real and differentiated from what is unreal, and to develop wisdom, which ultimately is scientific wisdom in the sense of its reality-oriented wisdom, at least as defined in Buddhism. Prajna, you know the word prajna or jnana. Those are such words. So that's what I would say about that question, whether Buddhism is a science. I would say, however, since Buddha's intention was to educate and re-educate people, to deprogram them, to help them deconstruct their indoctrinations in different societies and in different tribes and things about their identity and the nature of the dogmas about the nature of the world, including the nature of the gods and the demons and the physical properties around them and so on, and then openly try to experience, free of any programming, the nature of reality, and then based on that experience, come up with new sort of provisory theories, relativistic theories that make people, enable others to help them understand and enable us to interact in a harmonious manner and so on. So I would say Buddhism is more than a science, and more than a religion, and has elements of science and religion in it, which coexist quite okay, actually, in quite a decent manner, as different world theories and worldviews can coexist very well, as long as they don't, no one of them presents themselves as the absolute, the one that's absolutely true and real, and those who don't know it are somehow benighted, and therefore they have to be brainwashed not to believe the theory that the absolutist is trying to impose upon them. So that is where Buddhist science of the nature of how worldviews and a sense of identity are formed in people and in societies is very valuable to us, a valuable service to relativize, if you will. In fact, I would say just in general, which under this topic, that in modern thought and philosophy, either ethics or metaphysics, although basically they all claim they quit metaphysics, because they quit absolutist, old-fashioned metaphysics, you know, essentialist metaphysics. But that doesn't mean they've quit metaphysics from our view. But anyway, in other words, philosophy focused on what is the nature of reality, and which is what metaphysics means philosophically. And that in those fields today, relativism is considered a kind of a bad thing and is equated with chaotic nihilism and sort of someone who could do anything, get away with anything, you know, just things on the fly, you know, has no real rules that they care about and so on, something like that. And I think that's unfortunate. And it's a natural tendency among those whose cultural predisposition is to have absolute rules that come from some absolute source, which is from old-fashioned Western theism, Abrahamic theism, and therefore feel uncomfortable no longer having such an absolute sort of guideline about how you should live and what's the meaning of everything and so forth like that, and think that, and therefore fear nihilism, and therefore look to a new absolutism, which of course is then the absolutism of materialistic science, and becomes absolutistic scientism. However, I think one service that Buddhist philosophers can offer is to offer a vision of relativism as a nice middle way between nihilism, which is really anything goes and therefore dangerous, and absolutism, which is only I go, or what I believe goes, or those who agree with me go, and other people don't go. Let's put it that way. So relativism is, well, we all go in ways as best we can, trying to get along with each other, and our truths are relative truths, which mean they are valid and they are not false in a relative context. But we always want to be looking at that context and realizing others may see things and create a different context. And then in different contexts, they won't be absolute. So it keeps our critical mind going, even in relation to the rule that we're following. So those are, you could call relative rules, or rules that are good enough in specific situations, but not needing or requiring to be absolutely good, something like that. Okay, unless you have a definition of absolute, that it just means something you're very firm about, like not killing people we should be very firm about. So we can be relatively absolute about that rule, but only relatively, not absolutely absolute. And Buddhism is very good at this, de-absolutizing things and deconstructing false absolutes, and all absolutes in a way in the relative world are false, except for that one, that the relative world is relative. That's kind of like that's relatively absolute, you could say, something like that. Okay, that's on whether Buddhism is a science. Ding!
This episode of the Bob Thurman Podcast is a part of the ongoing series, Questioning Buddhism. To submit your questions, please visit bobthurman.com. Watch classic episodes of the Bob Thurman Podcast, remastered and remixed as educational videos on YouTube. To watch these free videos, please visit Tibet House US on YouTube. Every like, subscription, comment, and view helps support Tibet House's mission to present and preserve Tibetan culture. And now back to Bob with the second half of this week's episode.
Is the monastic tradition relevant for today's modern world, especially in the West? Definitely, in my opinion. And here I provoke laughter. So the question is monasticism relevant for today, and is especially in the West and in modern society? Do we need monasticism? And of course, in our Protestant ethic-dominated societies, even though we do have Catholics in them, and we do have Buddhist monks and nuns and things like that in them, which are really the only two traditions that make much about monks and nuns. Actually, the Hindus lately, since Buddhism disappeared kind of in India, they put it into their swamis, who are celibate, in that sense, therefore monks. And I guess there are some female celibates who you might consider nuns. And so because the celibacy is key to monk and nun, you have people who call themselves Zen monks, but they're not celibate, and therefore they're misusing the word monk, I'm afraid. They're Zen priests, they certainly can say that, or Zen reverends or ministers, you can say, but they're not monks. If they're married or if they have girlfriends or whatever, or boyfriends, you know, they're not monks and nuns. But they do that because of not knowing the history of the Zen tradition from the Meiji era, 19th century Japan, and how the government didn't like celibate people and therefore made monks marry to make them more socially acceptable, something like that. Okay, but do we need them today, these things, therefore? Now people say. Now, here the Dalai Lama laughs because I was a Buddhist monk briefly in my 20s for about 4.5 years. I was formally ordained about 1.5 years. And I lived like a monk, celibate and abstemious and with the vows of poverty and study and et cetera for another 3 years before that. I was like a novice, you could say. And then after a while, I quit. I resigned. And I decided in my case, I had to be better to be a lay person. And after doing that, you know, my wife rightly doesn't take responsibility. It wasn't like I fell head over heels and rushed off and ripped off my robes. I had already decided not to be a monk. And then actually among the women that I met subsequently, I happened to fall in love with someone. And so therefore, and then I followed the American or Western theory that you see quite a lot of, hear quite a lot of in Buddhist circles, Western Buddhist circles, that, you know, those were fine in those Asian societies, but we don't need to be monks. And we learn a lot from our wives, which in male cases is very true, and from children and having to raise children, being responsible citizens. And therefore, you know, we shouldn't bother with the monastic order particularly, and we can have a sangha community, which are Buddhist practitioners who are lay people. And that's more important for us here in the West. And you hear that a lot, and I subscribe to that for a while. Naturally, one wants to rationalize one's own behavior, as, you know, what one did was the cutting edge and the new wave of what should be done in the world. And I subsequently studied more carefully Buddhist history and world history, and I realized that the great problem of the world today, one of the two greatest problems, or three greatest problems in the world today, is militarism and military violence and military, you know, budgetary expenditure in weapons and weapons trading and dealing. This is a huge problem and could be self-destructive of the human species on this planet, at least. And I realizing that, and then I looked in history to where has there been a social antidote to militarism. And lo and behold, to my amazement, I discovered the only effective one in history has been monasticism as an institution. And there are different kinds of monasticism. They're not all, of course, the same. But the idea that the male, particularly male, but female also, but particularly male, that the males of a certain age would put that kind of macho, do-or-die attitude that we find in military training into finding the nature of their reality, gaining control over themselves, developing self-restraint, developing compassion and positive, also a strong positive mentality, wisdom, and overcoming ignorance and greed and hatred and envy and pride and this sort of thing in a sort of militant manner, like a military. That's monasticism. And Buddha was raised to be a general, I realize. You know, I guess we all assume that Buddha went to a liberal arts college when he was a prince in addition to partying. But he didn't. He went to a military academy because he was a prince. And princes are expected to be commander-in-chief of the society. So they have a military training. Of course, they do learn some liberal subjects, but they are trained to be generals and to marshal bodies of men to fight to defend their nation state, or, you know, a little bit blown up tribe into a city state, and in his era. And so he founded an institution that was a counter-military institution, actually, where people would receive the respect and the veneration and the subsidy in society that normally only soldiers receive. And in founding that, he created this antidote in society to violent militarism. In a way, you could say to violent non-violence. You know, the monks, because the monks are sort of violent with themselves a little bit, although he made a big point, even an example in his life, not to be too self-mortifying. But still, they are somehow self, you know, restraining and renunciant. And so that, in that sense, like a soldier. And they, like soldiers, shave their heads not to have lice in barracks, and they don't have women in the barracks in the old-fashioned story, but which means they behave badly when they, because they're not fully celibate by vow, but they are celibate in practice. And monks are celibate by practice and by vow. They shave their heads because they live in dormitories a little bit, or in close quarters with other monks when they're not living in nature in the societies with the climate appropriate to that. And so monasticism, now since militarism is our major planetary problem, one of our major planetary problems, a really dominant one in the sense that it could lead to our self-destruction, then we need the services of a social antidote to that social institution that is so powerful. And therefore, Catholic monasticism, which already exists, is an important institution, irrespective of whether the view is a Buddhist view or any other view. The fact that it leads men, and women too, but especially men, who are the Rambos, you know, have been, at least heretofore, most societies, the Rambos, to turn that kind of macho boot camp training into monastic boot camp training of how to be nonviolent and how to be gentle and how to be self-restraining in their negative emotions and negative actions, like killing people and taking their stuff and abusing and then looting and raping a society that you conquered and so forth, which soldiers do. And those are the really wrong things to do with other people and unethical things to do. So very much, and therefore Solanus teasingly says, I'm the most enthusiastic ex-monk about monasticism. He thinks that's very funny. And so do I. Do you need to be a monk or a nun in order to make significant progress in the Buddhist path? And here, of course, different people have different opinions. And I would say from the history of the tradition, you do need to be someone with equivalent determination and the equivalent prioritization of a monk or a nun, meaning that spiritual evolution and spiritual development and spiritual practices and scientific practices become your highest priority in life. I would answer that question, do you need to be a monk or nun, perhaps in the affirmative, because it may be that you have to have that level of prioritization in your life where making a living and being famous and being powerful and having sexuality and sexual relationships and so forth is you swear off of all those things, and they are at your below, some of them below the lowest priority, so you just don't engage in them. And you have to, of course, be in a society where people will support your life, feed you, meaning, and allow you shelter and allow you freedom from social duties in order to be able to do that, because committing suicide is not an option for attaining enlightenment, or going and living and starving yourself to death in a cave. That's not the way you can attain enlightenment. It takes it too long and too lengthy a process, even for the brightest human being. And so you need to have that level of prioritization even if you are not a formal monk or nun, and where you've really become determined, this is the high priority of your life. I'm going to develop my compassion. I'm not going to give in to my anger and my lust and my greed and my envy and my pride. And I'm not going to be sunk in depression and delusion to the sort of life and death level, no way. So when one makes those resolves and puts the priority to be undoing those things that cause suffering of the human being and enclose that human being all from enlightenment, awareness of their own reality, which means awareness of their own reality, then you do need to be that. But it is possible in the modern economy, and especially in a country where they don't really respect monks and nuns, which I'm afraid most of the industrialized Protestant ethic dominated societies, they really don't. And it's particularly in those societies that think that everything you get out of life, that the only goods in life are those you have to get in this life. And because you don't have a future life, because your mind and spirit do not exist, actually. They're just, your brain makes you think they do, but you don't. You know, under the sort of dogma of materialism, the scientific worldview that people learn in high school, you know, and grade school and college and so forth, even if they're humanists, literary people. In those societies, there won't be social support for people who make the highest priority their spiritual evolutionary development. And therefore, in those societies, I think it would be possible for a person to gain enough livelihood where they have enough wealth to then be able to be kind of on retreat year after year, at least for a time, and sort of be part-time monks or something like that, or be few year-long monks and things like that. And in that case, you don't need to be a formal monk or nun, but in a way, for some period of time, you will be the equivalent of a monk or a nun. And then going in the other direction, monks and nuns in Buddhist history, and especially in the latter phase of Indian Buddhism, and in Tibetan Buddhism, and Mongolian Buddhism subsequently, it could be that some monks and nuns, but relatively few, but a small percentage of monks and nuns, reach a stage as a monk or a nun where they need to go on into other types of practices where the monk or the nun vow, particularly in regard to sensuality, could become a bit of an obstacle in certain types of practice, not necessarily for everyone, but for some. And therefore, there's a tradition where, like in the case of someone like Naropa, or the many of the famous adepts in India who resigned at some stage from being monastics and left, or sometimes they were thrown out of monasteries because they were infringing on certain basic rules, often having to do with sensuality. And in those cases, therefore, the monk or a nun avocation is not necessarily permanent for a person. But those are exceptional, and they're very carefully noted in the tradition as exceptional, because otherwise, you know, young people in adolescence or in their 20s, when they're sexually very vibrant and vital, would think it's absolutely essential I can often have a girlfriend or a boyfriend, and I can still be focusing highest on my spiritual practice, and although I have this boyfriend or girlfriend, I'll be doing high level spiritual practice with them. So then they will all leave the monk and the nunhood. So those people who are not yet really at that stage, and there's a definition of what that stage is. They already have had some kind of a visceral level, maybe not total, but some viscerality of their level of understanding of selflessness or emptiness or identitylessness or realitylessness, all of the terms that you have for that. Great negation, that great transcendence of the rigidity of self-identity. You know, they have to have some taste of that, at least, if not full level of it, which comes only in full enlightenment. And they have to have some sort of positive attitude, which is the bodhisattva attitude of everything I do. I want to make love my highest priority. I want to be loving and gentle and tolerant of other beings. I don't want to be violate them in any way. I don't want to harm them. And I'm determined not to, and so forth. There has to be that kind of a level. And in a way, in the Buddhist case, everything, even if I do things that are not in the, if I engage in sensuality, if I engage in things that I wouldn't normally engage in as a monk or a nun, I'm doing it for the purpose of attaining enlightenment for the benefit of all beings, becoming a perfect Buddha for the benefit of all beings, and actually accelerating that evolutionary development in a single life or in a few lives type of thing. Future lives as well as this one. So those things are required in order to, you know, if you have been a strong monk and a nun, and then you reach a level where then you need to maybe interact more with others in a less rule-governed way, and then it's acceptable to resign as a monk or a nun. And that isn't articulated very much because it's considered to be so exceptional in history. And maybe we need to articulate it more now, actually, to make people realize that monkhood and nunhood, if they're very, very sharp types and they have a very strong desire to be really a complete Buddha, not just some calm down person, it might be good for them to be aware that, well, there's a level where then the monk or a nun thing is not perfect. And you could have rigid monks and nuns who then behind the scenes are harmful to people and so forth. And in that case, they are abusing the monk or a nun role. It's not helping them, and it's not helping the society. So that could be more articulated more in the future. Because there is a big difference in the modern situation and the previous situation, which is the previous were basically agricultural societies with a small literate urban population and an elite urban population. There was no such idea of universal education. And we may overdo our notion of universal education and we may be over-educating some people who don't need it, and it makes them even unhappy. But there are critiques like that. Let's have more apprenticeship programs, you know, and so forth, for people whose, you know, academic scoring is low. But, and that may be so, but the case is we do have the wonderful thing of universal literacy, which Buddha would have applauded had it existed in his time, which Buddha would applaud if he were here today. So more people can really use the educational aspect of the Buddhist sciences and the Buddhist ethical and social traditions and things like that. And that's really valuable. It doesn't mean they need to be Buddhists, but it means that Buddhism can offer its services to a much wider percentage of the population. And it's unrealistic economically, and industrial societies governed by a certain social ethic where sort of no free lunch societies, it's kind of unrealistic to expect those societies right away to jump in and have like 100 or 1,000 times the number of monks and nuns than the Catholics will inflict on them. It's not realistic. So there are new models that can be devised, but still, the idea that I always say that when people say, has Buddhism reached the West, you know, when Buddhist monasticism is fully respected and supported by Western Buddhists, at least, then Buddhism has reached the country. If it's not supported by Buddhists, even by Buddhists, then I would say Buddhism is not really here. But Buddhist ideas, some Buddhist practices, but Buddhism isn't there until you have true respect for what the avocation of the monk and the nun, the celibate bhikshu, and which really you say male and female mendicant, bhikshu and bhikshuni, that is people who need the free lunch and who expect it and who receive it from a grateful population that they are putting their efforts so strongly and they're prioritizing so greatly their personal development for the sake of everyone, which is a real thing, that motivation, even though they may be withdrawn in a cave. But the fact that they're doing it for everyone, their ultimate goal is to be a Buddha for everyone, which is the Bodhisattva way, is important. It's not just a verbal thing to excuse hiding in a cave, not at all. If you do it just for yourself, it has one value, but it's sort of minimalist value, but which is still has value, but minimalist. But if you're doing it motivated for all beings, like Bodhisattva motivation, it has much greater value. And it is a social act, actually. Okay, so ding, that's answered it up. So now, what is Buddha nature? Okay, so Buddha nature is an English term developed on Tathagata Garbha, is the original Sanskrit term. Tathagata means Buddha, of course, it's the name of Buddha, but it's particularly picking out in among the names of Buddha, the name of the Buddha as a transcended being or transcendent being, in the sense of one who transcended their normal absolutist identity habits, including the nihilistic absolutism that sort of that in their absence everything is really ultimately nothing. So someone who has gone into an experience of the nature of reality, gone or come into an experience of the nature of reality, gata or agata, where they fully experience what it is accurately and precisely, and this knowledge and this experience makes them released from suffering, happy, nirvana of some type, level, to some degree. And so that then the potential that everyone has to achieve that type of a being, to transcend their narrow self-definition and self-experience of myself as this thing isolated inside my skin, you know, from inside my material body, and maybe as just only a material being, but rigidly I am always me, or a spiritual one, I'm always me with such and such a soul, it could be the variety, it would still be a rigid identity habit pattern. But within that, I have a nature of a potential to really experience that my reality as interrelated with all things and all beings. You know, people wrongly think that Buddha discovered some place outside the world where you go, and that nirvana is outside the world. Even some Buddhists still think that. But actually, Buddha was pretty clear that that means relativity. What's outside the world is an absolute version of the world. That is your version, belonging to you. what is not there is a self that is an absolute, unchanging, fixed self within your relational being. What is there is your relational self, which is constantly changing and influenced by all your its possessions, its embodiment, its circumstances, its society. So Buddha nature, therefore, is that potential. Now, when it is said in more sophisticated, I always thought, therefore, it was emptiness itself in some way, because I was foolishly thinking that emptiness is a thing, which I'm afraid people do. They even have an experience which feels like they're float. They are emptiness. They don't feel even like they're floating in it. They just feel they have become it, that everything is empty, including the self, and they think that's enlightenment. And it is a shocking experience, but it is an enlightenment. Actually, we have to be very clear. And it comes from having the wrong idea that emptiness is a thing, apart from some non-empty thing. There's an empty thing. And that's wrong, because emptiness is also empty. Emptiness thought of as a thing is also empty. So emptiness actually means relationality, that all things are related. It's really what it means. It means that all things are related of any non-relational essence or component or ultimate being or intrinsic reality or intrinsic identity. Everything is empty of that, meaning it's only interrelational. So there, in other words, there's no indivisible particle, for example. All particles infinitely divide until they dissolve under analysis. They're divided into where there's nothing to find. Their parts are, and then their parts all dissolve under analysis. And Buddha predicted that, which I would say was ratified by quantum physics and announced in 1926 in the Copenhagen Declaration, and it still exists among some physicists in what they call the Copenhagen Interpretation. Buddha discovered that anyway thousands of years ago, and it was articulated and explicated and elaborated more powerfully. So the Buddha nature, you know, is in a way you can say roughly, it is emptiness, because the Buddha nature is everyone's natural relativity. Since we are connected all interconnected with each other in an infinite relativity, if you can make such an expression, you know, an inconceivable relativity, then we all have the chance to relate to positive things to the beings who already are enlightened within that relativity and who experience that relativity as nirvana, as love and joy and bliss, as bliss void indivisible, bliss freedom indivisible, nirvana samsara non-dual. And you can yourself become one of them, rather than become one of their patients, one of their clients, seeking freedom from suffering with their help, or with beings like them with their help. So that's in that sense, Buddha nature is emptiness, you can say. But then on the other hand, there's Buddha nature has sort of two uses in two different divisions of Buddhist thought, which is really beautiful. And this relates to a book that I recently worked on, the translation, a book by one of Tsongkhapa's disciples, Gyaltsepje, his first successor, like his Tsongkhapa's Mahakashyapa, you could say, which is called the Sublime Continuum Super Commentary, which we just published from Columbia University Press, our Institute of Buddhist Studies. And in that, I learned a wonderful thing that I was not aware of before, that in the mind-only school, or the idealistic school of Buddhism, called Vijnanavada, or mind-only, Chittamatra, something like that Sanskrit word, then the Buddha nature is sort of like a little mini Buddha. You know, the Buddha kind of allows people who have a strong attachment to having a fixed soul that is belong individually to them, but is somehow yet absolute. That they have a Buddha, they don't have one of those, but they have a Buddha nature. And he knows that they're going to understand that Buddha nature as some fixed thing that they have, sort of a new fixed thing that they have, their eventual Buddhahood. Sort of seminally inside, almost like a Sankhya understanding of Buddha's, of idealistic thought. And that's an Indian philosophical school that thinks the cause pre-exists in the effect. And so that's one form of it. But the Prasangika Madhyamika form, or the Madhyamika or centrist form of it, is more exciting and kind of more fun. Where it's, what it is, it's the way you are It's your nature as understood by Buddha. Because you have to understand, when someone becomes a Buddha, it's not like they see themselves as one with Nirvana and other beings are still lost in the swamp and in vicious suffering and in terrible health and whatever. It isn't like that. They see Buddha would break their Buddhas would have broken their Bodhisattva vows at Buddhahood if they abandoned beings into a realm of suffering and themselves entered a realm of Nirvana without bringing them with them. What it is, it's more subtle and more nuanced than that. Buddhas see other beings in the reality of the other beings, which is that they are all in Nirvana, made of Nirvana, that their reality is bliss, that the strong force of the universe is clear light of bliss, which is infinitely and infinite in its power, infinite in its extent.
Weekly interstitial music provided by Tenzing Chogyal. Used with the artist's permission, all rights reserved. To learn more about the music of Tenzing Chogyal, please visit his website at tenzingchogyal.com. Study Buddhism up close and personal with Robert Thurman during upcoming Tibet House U.S. trips with Geographic Expeditions. Trips in 2018 include Mongolia and Bhutan. To learn about these Tibet House member trips and the benefits of becoming a monthly supporter, please visit tibethouse.us. Thanks for tuning in and Tashi Dalek.